COVID Action.
Welcome to COVID Action Bulletin, the official radio program and podcast of COVID Action Magazine, where we've been exposing the COVID action of the U.S. government and plutocrats worldwide since 1978. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa, and we're very happy to be here with you on COVID Action Bulletin. Millions of people took to the streets around the world on March 2nd in solidarity with the people of Gaza, as Israel is reportedly preparing an invasion of Rafah later this week, just before the start of Ramadan. From New York City and Havana to Albuquerque, Caracas, British Columbia, Kuala Lumpur, Seoul, and well beyond, this massive day of mobilization shows that the movement against the Israeli genocide of Palestinians will not slow down until these attacks are over. And even the Democratic Party is being forced to shift its rhetoric in the face of mounting pressure, though it remains steadfast in its support for Israel. Biden's recent statements about increasing aid to Gaza and Kamala Harris's comment that we need an immediate ceasefire for at least 6 weeks will come while the U.S. continues to veto ceasefire resolutions in the U.N. But new surveys show that more than two-thirds of people in the U.S. support the call for a permanent ceasefire and de-escalation of violence, and a brand new Center for Economic Policy Research and YouGov study shows that 62% of respondents who voted for Biden in 2020 agree with the statement, quote, "The U.S. should stop weapon shipments to Israel until Israel discontinues its attacks on the people of Gaza." So to talk about March 2nd and all of this, we are joined by Miriam Osman, an organizer with the Palestinian Youth Movement. Miriam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. I want to first talk about March 2nd. There have been many, many days of actions called by the Palestinian Youth Movement and other organizations. March 2nd seems to have been the largest of these, both in size and in scope, in terms of there being rallies in Cuba, in Caracas, and I mean, all over the world. So talk about the organizing that has gone into this and what it was like, where you are, and from some of the other mobilizations that you've heard about.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, Chris, March 2nd was a historic time for our movement. And it brought millions of people out into the streets all around the world and all across the United States. But really, I think March 2nd is or was a testament to the growth and strength of this mass movement for Palestine right now. You know, we're able to organize and coordinate actions in nearly every single U.S. city with actions around the world, I think shows where the people stand on Palestine. And who all is willing to be out in the street. I mean, here in New York City, we had a unfortunate rainy forecast. I won't lie, we were a little bit worried that we wouldn't get the turnout we were expecting. We went into it, you know, thinking maybe we'll get 5,000 people, you know, hopefully more. We were really hopeful that we would have more. And we had 50,000 people on the street. Honestly, it's not surprising to me that we had that many people, because the number of people that we've seen really engaged every single week through our organizing efforts has been exponential. You know, every week there's new people who are coming into the movement, who are getting organized with us, and who are taking action not just through street protests, but also in their neighborhoods. So yeah, it's really a testament to how much this movement has developed, and also to the moment that we're in right now. You mentioned the Ramadan deadline and the threat of the invasion of Rafah. This is a serious, serious threat. And I think people around the world are watching this live on their phones. They're watching it play out on social media. They're hearing from people in Gaza in a way that I don't think has happened in the past, to actually watch in lifetime genocide being carried out against the Palestinian people. So the sense of urgency is there. And this day, March 2nd, was really critical for mounting as much pressure as possible on the political class, on our government here in the United States, because we refuse to accept the continued support for the Israeli genocide on the Palestinian people. And what we're seeing is, you know, unfortunately, again, it's not surprising, because we know where the interests of the ruling class lie. We know where the interests of our government lie. So it's not surprising to see them continue to stand firm with the Zionist project. But we have to make sure that we keep this pressure up. You know, one other point about March 2nd, if you noticed, was there was a total corporate media blackout of March 2nd, which again, it shows you exactly what we're up against. And it shows you that the government is scared of our movement. They know the power that we have. They know that we were able to organize and mobilize together with millions of people across the planet. They see that threat, and censoring that, making sure that that isn't publicized, is one of the tactics that they use in the kind of war against this movement. Again, it's not going to deter us, because we've already seen some shifts happening. And most importantly, we're seeing a massive shift in the consciousness in the United States, and a massive shift in the sheer number of people who are willing to get organized and be out in the street. So yeah, March 2nd was really, really an incredible day, and it was great to be part of it.
Certainly, Miriam. You know, there's so many things I'm thinking about as you're talking, and you're absolutely right about the corporate media blackout. I think on every level, we need to be enraged by this, because the fact that we had, I would genuinely say, 500,000 or more, I don't even know, frankly, the scale of numbers in the United States, if not 1 million to 2 million people in the United States protesting. I mean, that's the kind of numbers we're talking about. New York had 50,000. I saw also Cambridge, Mass. Had something like 50,000 to 70,000. I don't remember the exact official numbers that were put out. I mean, mass actions in Chicago. I was blown away by the size I saw in Chicago, Denver, Colorado. I mean, almost every major U.S. city in the entire country had thousands, tens of thousands of people in the street. And so, you know, I actually, like I mentioned often on the show, I work for Breakthrough News, and I put together a compilation video of just of 16 of just of those cities. There are so many more that weren't included just in that video that I put together. But if you just look at the raw sheer numbers, it will blow your mind to think that even in Michigan, in Detroit, they had, I think, 3,000 to 4,000 people in Detroit, which is a really big deal. I mean, it speaks to what we're talking about earlier with Joe Biden and all the unconfirmed votes that they had as well for him, because they're like, you know what? At the end of the day, like, we're going to mobilize and get people to bring the energy that's in the streets into the ballot box. And we're seeing that happen all across the country in different ways. And I'm sure we're going to see that come the results of Super Tuesday. But regardless, I wanted to say this in this corporate media blackout, that it felt very intentional. I mean, it felt very much so that they're learning from their mistakes. I mean, I can remember in the early anti-war movement during the fight against the Iraq war, the media covered in mass. I mean, like wall-to-wall plastered, just covered the demonstrations until one day it just stopped. And it stopped because it recognized that by giving more airtime to the demonstrations, it also then spreads the message further. And this is exactly what the political establishment does not want to happen. They see the writing on the wall. Obviously, Kamala Harris is coming out and making comments, because perhaps I don't know exactly the way the Democrats are moving, but they picked Kamala and not Biden for a reason to make statements. And so it says a lot to me about the fact that the Democrats must be seeing the writing on the wall, that this is not going to go well for them, especially with the stat that you gave earlier, Chris. So I do think that it's so obvious to me that it isn't just that there are protests, but there are true, genuine power. There's true, genuine power being built on the ground. And this is something that is in a lot of ways new in the U.S. in the last, you know, I would say a few decades, because I would say since 2020 and 2014, the Black Lives Matter movement, we had a lot of mass protests, but not quite the same building of infrastructure and power that we've been seeing in this uprising, which is something that's incredible to witness, that you can go through months of struggle where you have highs and you have a couple of lows for a couple of weeks, and you have like incredible highs all over again. And that speaks to the fact that not only are people seeing what's on TV, they're seeing, well, more likely what's on their cell phone, what's on their social media feeds. They're seeing what's going on in Gaza and they're responding to it, but that there's an organized call to keep responding. And I think that, you know, PYM, the Palestinian Youth Movement, has done an incredible job, especially just your coverage of keeping people in the know about what's actually happening. I mean, some of the videos that you put out are about disruptions of politicians that are happening all across the country, that there's also quite a significant media blackout on. Like, a lot of the day-to-days of what's going on in this movement are not being reported on. So, Miriam, I would love to hear from you about some of those other holes that are not necessarily being filled by the corporate media and they're turning their cameras away from.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's exactly how you said it, Rachel. I mean, they see the power of this movement and they're terrified because they know what's coming. They see that now there's an entire group of people in the United States who see through the two-party system completely, who have lost faith, no longer see any kind of legitimacy in Democratic Party. And it's a big threat. And again, with the holes that you're mentioning with the corporate media, we really should not be surprised. I keep saying that, I know, but we know that the corporate media is only responsive really to the interests of the state, of corporate power. It's unsurprising that they're not reporting on any of these disruptions or these protests. And like you said, on any given day, I challenge you, on any given day in the United States, to find a day where there hasn't been some sort of disruption happening for Palestine. On any given day, you know, just yesterday, we had a disruption of an Israeli tech conference by Google workers. Today, we had a disruption of Senator Gillibrand, I think it was. And it's happening all over the country. I'm just speaking here to New York City, but all over the country, in any given city, I'm sure that on every single day, you will find some sort of disruption of politicians or of various, you know, Zionist interests and stakeholders. So again, it's highly unsurprising, but exactly to the point you were making, which is that this is a highly, you know, organized movement now, and we have the infrastructure to keep it going. You know, March 2nd happened 5 months in, since October 7th, at 150 days, basically, since the start of this genocide. And we had bigger numbers than ever before. So it gives me a lot of hope for this movement. And being on the street on March 2nd, you could really feel the power that people have and their commitment to this struggle.
No, Miriam, I really definitely agree with you there. I think it's important to hold on to hope because times are really dark right now. I mean, it is a very serious situation that Palestinian people are finding themselves in. I mean, one of the things that I'd like to hear from you, too, is a little bit more of those details, because the truth of what's going on in Rafah, I don't think people quite grasp it, the population density. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it quite as much as I've seen some of those maps that do a really great job of showing that there are just the millions of people that are being shoved in such a small space in such a concentrated way, the kind of damage that an on-the-ground invasion would do. I mean, it would be truly an escalation of great proportions if Israel is to move forward with this. And so I'm not surprised, of course, that Kamala Harris the Biden administration is in some way, shape or form trying to make themselves look better in anticipation for that, not to mention these airlifted, the packages that are being dropped as well. And the U.S. is saying, oh, we're giving some aid to Gaza, and it's just complete cover for just supporting genocide. I mean, it's just I feel hopeful in that I've seen not a lot of people fall for it. That's been very, very good in my mind. I've been really surprised to see a lot of people just immediately react and say, oh, well, you know, there's a catch. What's the catch? What exactly is it? It's really not appeasing people. And I think it has a lot to do with the fact that they waited so long to say anything at all. I mean, the Biden administration is just gung-ho about Israel. Where do you think people are going to look to? Who are they going to trust? I mean, you lost the trust of millions of people in the United States who don't agree with the actions of the Biden administration. So, of course, they're going to look to movements, which is exactly how consciousness has built so strong over the last 5 months, so to speak. But Miriam, I would love to hear from you a little bit more of the details about what this deal looks like in the coming days. You know, March 10th, the deadline is looming. What does that mean for Palestinians, and why does the pressure need to keep staying up?
I mean, as you mentioned, Rachel, it's the situation on the ground in Gaza is it's actually, I think, beyond most people's comprehension. You have people who have been coming back or leaving Gaza and describing really unimaginable horrors, things that I don't think that any average American or person would actually be able to comprehend the horror of. And as you said, you know, you have millions of people who have been pushed into an area that is smaller than Manhattan. Imagine what it would be like if there was an invasion of Rafah. We already saw, you know, what's been happening with airstrikes on Rafah and the number of martyrs from those airstrikes. But it's also not just Rafah. Northern Gaza is facing a famine. As of a couple days ago, the number of children who had died of malnutrition reached 16. And it's widespread. We saw the flower massacre last week. Total Zionist brutality in this war of annihilation. And for Kamala Harris to then make these remarks where, you know, she uses the word ceasefire. And in part, I think because of the immense pressure that our movement has been putting on the administration, she uses the word ceasefire, but she absolutely does not mean a ceasefire. She is parroting the Israeli line, as is to be expected by the U.S. administration. What she's really calling for is a 6-week pause. It's not a ceasefire. So it's a slap in the face. It's also like, for people here in the movement, forget what it means, you know, in general. But it's also like, do you think we're stupid? You know, like we've been out in the streets every day. Do you think we're going to buy this crap, basically? So she uses the word ceasefire. She doesn't mean ceasefire. And she also says that during this pause, there would be more aid that's dropped in. They would start rebuilding hospitals. But there's no indication of what that would mean. And the aid thus far that has been sent, supposedly, has been not just inadequate, but actually disrespectful. Yeah, it's completely, completely inadequate. There's also no mention of a withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza. Absolutely no mention of an end to the illegal occupation, which has been a key demand. The number of prisoners that she mentions would be released, Palestinian prisoners, was only 400. Of 8,000 Palestinian political prisoners. It's absolutely a deal that is calling for the Palestinian resistance to accept a negotiated Israeli victory. That's what she's calling for, which the Palestinian resistance is never going to accept. And actually, just today, you know, Hamas put forward a comprehensive ceasefire deal, a response, you know, to these negotiations, really the first time that such a comprehensive response has been laid out that indicates, you know, even names of prisoners to be released. But it calls for, you know, a withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza with international guarantees, an end to the aggression on Gaza, you know, not a temporary pause or any of this, you know, kind of totally liquidated language that doesn't address the humanitarian situation adequately. Calling for freedom of movement for people who've been displaced in Gaza so that they can return to their homes in the north, for aid to be allowed into Gaza. And then, of course, for the start of a phased prisoner exchange process that would actually secure the release of Palestinian prisoners who are being held illegally by the Zionist entity. So, you know, let's also not forget the bigger picture here, because what's happening is we have the United States supporting this Israeli deal, wherein Israel is carrying out a genocide on a population that has faced 75 years of displacement and dispossession. They're carrying out a genocide on people who have been occupied illegally, and the Palestinians are rightfully resisting this occupation. So for her to then frame the inability to reach a deal thus far, she framed it as she blamed it on the Palestinian resistance. She basically implied that it's the Palestinian resistance who are refusing to reach a ceasefire deal, when we know this is an absolute lie. The Palestinian resistance has been willing to have a ceasefire deal for months, and it's the Israelis who have refused and who are intent on continuing this genocide. So, you know, her deal is really no deal at all, and her remarks are completely nonsensical. You know, it's just blatant lies. And again, total support for Israel and in line with what we've been seeing previously, but now with the addition of new language that she thinks is going to confuse us. But because we are so organized, I don't think anyone in the movement is confused, and everyone completely understands what's going on here. One other point about this is she gives these remarks on Bloody Sunday in Selma, Alabama, a day that commemorates the brutal police repression against civil rights activists. She gives these remarks on this day, and it is totally a dishonor to the memory of the freedom fighters of Selma, Alabama, for her to try to frame this deal as some sort of fight for freedom along the lines of what happened in Selma and the civil rights movement. It's so disrespectful. It's such a dishonor. And for her to make these remarks the day after we saw, again, police repression against many of the protests that happened on March 2nd, protests that are demanding a ceasefire deal that actually sets terms for liberation and for freedom. The irony is, I don't think is not lost on anybody here. Yeah, we have to continue to maintain the pressure because we know that it does get results. And most importantly, we know that we're building our power as we do it. We'll have to see what happens now in response to the deal that has been put forward by the Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought up the fact that it was Bloody Sunday. I mean, all of those things, because it's offensive. You know, this show is Covert Action, but some of the stuff they do is just overt. I mean, it really overtly offensive. And I mean, like dropping 38,000 meals for millions of people who are starving. There are children who are literally starving and dying of malnutrition. It is unfathomable that anyone could fall for the idea that 38,000 meals is going to make a dent. Like, and they're continuing to send weaponry, to send money, to have Antony Blinken try to negotiate a peace deal. The only thing Blinken should be doing is being bound up in a room in The Hague, frankly. In our last few minutes here, I just want to go a little more into the Democrats, because they're really showing, again, overtly showing that they are not on the side of the people. They're not on the side of liberation or, in fact, of democracy. There have been ceasefire resolutions and, you know, introduced in city after city and town after town. I'm here in New Haven, Connecticut. We introduced one in December. It finally got moved to a committee last night in March because people held a 3.5-hour public speak out, public people's hearing on a ceasefire. This is a board of alders that meets monthly, and they had refused. And it's all Democrats, by the way. There are no Republicans in New Haven, Connecticut city government. They refused for 4 months to move a ceasefire resolution. In Hartford, Connecticut, the six of the Democrats on their board abstained from a ceasefire resolution, which, I mean, they're cowards, really, to abstain from a ceasefire resolution. And then, of course, at the national level, we see 100,000. I just want to go back to this as we close, 100,000 undecided or uncommitted votes in Michigan. Of course, we are recording the evening of Super Tuesday, so too early for us to know what these results in a number of other states are going to be. But I think we're seeing this. People are realizing that not only are the Democrats not going to support Palestinian liberation, support any of the causes that, you know, people are in vast agreement on, but that in fact we do need our own political mobilization and our own political forces. And so that's organizations like PYM and like so many others who have been out in the streets and organizing. So I want to ask you in that context, you know, what's next in New York City? Because many of our listeners are going to hear this Wednesday morning on WBAI, but also, you know, what's next in general for the movement? What do you see as the next steps to keep up this movement?
What's next is that we continue to do what we're doing. We continue to place maximum pressure. We continue to mobilize. We can't underestimate the power of sustained mass mobilization. We continue to bring people into organizations and build power that way. Because like you said, people completely understand now that if you vote, there's probably not much that's going to happen. If you vote Democrat, if you vote Republican, it's going to end up with the same result, which is imperialist war criminals who are profiting from the murder of people all around the world. And once people see that, once they break through that, I don't think there's any going back. And there's only moving forward with continuing to organize and mobilize. So we're going to be mounting the pressure. We have a massive rally coming up on March 8th for International Working Women's Day, which is going to be really important again. And it will be happening as a shut it down day all across the country. And we'll have more days coming up after that. The 13th will be the one after that. So, you know, I just encourage people to stay tuned, to stay involved, and we're going to see, I'm sure, really big things coming out of this movement, you know, especially ahead of the Ramadan deadline for people to really just make sure that they're keeping up with what's happening and ready to mobilize whenever it's necessary.
Certainly, Miriam, March 8th, International Working Women's Day. It's going to be, I'm very I am very excited in some ways to see those connections be openly made the way that they need to be. I mean, like in every way, shape, and form. I know Jill Biden recently was interrupted at an event that she was hosting, supposedly to uplift and support progressive women who have never once spoken out about Palestine, have never talked about the women in Gaza who are giving birth without anesthesia, let alone the children that are dying, that mothers have to watch. I mean, there's just so much that we can get into there that's absolutely necessary. And I think that's one of the things that to me gives me a lot of hope, is that so many people all across the United States in particular, but all around the world, but especially in the United States, in the belly of the beast, we have so many people really recognizing the U.S. empire for what it is, because putting that pressure is necessary. People in the United States have that duty to put that very specific kind of pressure on the U.S., because if the U.S. withdraws funding from Israel and actually takes a stand against this war, it can absolutely end. Like, there is a real possibility that the people of the United States can turn the tides of this war. And so there must be that kind of urgency, that every single person counts, every single individual that comes out to the streets makes a difference. And I think that that's one thing a lot of people feel, you know, well, what can I do in the face of something so big? What you can do is you can be out in the streets, you can build power, and you can actually get involved. You know, there's a lot of volunteers. I know in New York City, there's all the different things that are happening. I know that the People's Forum has a volunteers meeting every Monday night that I know you guys are a part of, Miriam. So there's a lot for people to plug into. You don't have to be out here adrift. There's a whole movement to be a part of that we can all build together. Nonetheless, we are going to have to leave it right there. But before we go, if you like what you heard today and you want to support independent journalism, go to patreon.com/covertactionmagazine and become a patron. We can only do this show with the support of our listeners. So if you want to hear more, be sure to go to our Patreon to support. You've been listening to Covert Action Bulletin. I'm Rachel Hu.
And I'm Chris Garaffa. Covert Action Bulletin is the official show of Covert Action Magazine and is brought to you by way of WBAI 99.5 FM, Pacifica Radio, New York. If you missed any of our episodes, you can subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts by searching for Covert Action Bulletin or listen on your station's archives. We are all out of time for today. Thanks for listening to Covert Action Bulletin.